I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Disasters, and eventually
the end of the world. Do you lock your doors at night to keep the terrorists out, or do you just sit there all vulnerable in your undies waiting for the spring season of the Are You Serious show? If you've been slacking on security, you've done the right thing because we're back. And no two-bit fundamentalist or homeland podcast security shit list is going to keep us down. No, brothers and sisters, welcome to the spring season of the Are You Serious show. We'll be talking to security expert Bruce Schneier later in the show. But first, Jeff Deal is somewhere behind me. He might be holding a camera. He might not. And, of course, the astonishing and unforgettable Diana Brown.
Well, with an introduction like that, I'm pretty excited. It's great to be back, and as many people will know, the tulips are blooming, spring is upon us, and a lot of things are burgeoning on the internet, and I'm sure everybody knows about what's going on with tech blogger and author Kathy Sierra and her recent spate of death threats that she's received, both on her own website and on a couple of other sites, one known as meankids.org, and then the other one posting unclebobisms.com, I believe. So my understanding of this situation is that it started online last month when a tech activist from San Francisco, Tara Hunt, posted on her blog about the importance of having a higher purpose in web work. And a lot of discussion ensued, and mostly centered around the post of a gentleman named Chris Locke. He's probably best known for his book, The Clue Train Manifesto, and he touts the notion in that book that the internet was taking over the business world, or is taking over. It seems Locke and Hunt started debating.
They locked horns.
Locke and Hunt locked horns, and the hunt was on, and it got kind of ugly. And then Kathy Sierra got involved, and she defended Hunt in a post on the website, and she basically... The website being Mean Kids. Now, what brought this about was Tara Hunt said, well, these people are behaving like mean kids, which, of course, prompted them to start a website called meankids.org. You have to applaud their initiative. And so she, Sierra, went on, defended Hunt, and then basically it's being said, although I didn't read that particular post, almost daring people to come after her instead. So they did. And on... during this, on a Saturday, meankids.org site went down, and the new site that I mentioned, unclebobism.com, went up. And there are some horrible pictures, sexually graphic content. There's been some threats. And the thing that's coming out of this, I mean, it's very unfortunate that, you know, Ms. Sierra is dealing with this, but what's coming out of this is this question of whether or not people should, okay, two things, and I'm fascinated by this. One is, should people who have or moderate or own these sites that just general, you know, run-of-the-mill folk can post to, should they be responsible for that content? And should there be a higher level of policing that content? And it brings us back to freedom of speech.
This has been the never-ending discussion on the web.
Exactly.
And having the legal question of whether a site... owner is responsible for what people post on their site, I think, was answered in the negative. That
yes.
they're not. Is it, anybody else know that? I'm pretty sure it's that's a negative. But did she really receive death threats? And the one description I read was that there was a collage photograph posted of her, like, being strangled by her panties or
like,
something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, there's an
and
image of
she
her.
Really panicked.
Seriously.
But, I mean, it's one thing. It's a lot easier to make a collage than it is to kill somebody. And it's a lot less risky.
Well, have you ever made a collage? Are you? I mean, the whole scissors
I've
situation.
I've killed a few people.
Which was probably a lot easier than making a collage. But
collages are harsh.
Well, we are... being glib about it, but she did receive, I did go to her website.
I just
website.
Wonder if she overreacted a little bit.
Well, and that's a question. A lot of her supporters have said, you're overreacting, don't be ridiculous. And she did get some pretty direct threats, one of which was, I paraphrase, I hope someone slits your throat and has a happy ending down your gob, was the words they used. And they didn't use happy ending, and that's pretty direct. And she said the police are taking it very seriously. And
what's the role of the Clutrain manifesto guy in all this? He's still, he's pretty happy to have done Mean Kids. I've talked to him before. I've talked to Mr. Locke before.
Well, he goes on to say...
He didn't seem like he was going to, be causing any major trouble. If anything, he seemed like a geek who was trying too hard to be Gonzo.
Well,
maybe that's when it
the one
happens.
Thing that he wanted to point out was that it wasn't on a site that he was affiliated with, either Mean Kids or Uncle Bobisms, where the actual death threat occurred. That was posted directly to her site by an unknown poster, and they don't know why. And so to quote him, he said, well, there's no linkage between the death threat and what was posted on her site. There was an inference in the way that she blogged about it that these were related incidents. And he goes on to say, we got tarred with the brush that we were homicidal stalker killers. And he said, if he's apologetic about anything, it would be for being naive and believing that your friends or people who are marginally your acquaintances are not going to do anything like that. But she's gotten a lot of support, a tremendous outpouring of support. She's also gotten more people saying...
Did you say that she at some point kind of said, bring them on to her critics?
Well, what happened was during the debate between Hunt and Locke, she went onto the blog, the Mean Kids blog, and said, I support Tara and come after me instead was not specifically what she said, but that was the inference that people took from it and did so.
Well, I think, in terms of an argument, if you're saying, I'm on this other person's side in the discussion and come after me, it doesn't mean that you're inviting death threats.
Exactly.
But you should know who the audience is that you're talking to.
You're talking to,
I mean, you're on the internet and griefing is sort of built in on different levels with different people. Some people, that's all they do is go after targets to harass them or annoy them, and other people only do it occasionally when they're in a flame war, and a few people never do it. But there's something, I think, that's sort of built into internet communications that's this kind of prankster, loser, nerd kind of, I can toy with you whenever I want, and you should keep that in mind. And I think, if you're anybody who's been on the web for a while and done a lot of communication, you should know that. That doesn't mean that you're not going to get paranoid if somebody sends an anonymous death threat to you. You're very susceptible to paranoia whenever you have an anonymous, communication like that. But you need to be able at some point to step back and go, okay, yeah, I need to see this in its proper context.
Death threats are cheap on the internet.
It's almost like theater, and
improv theater. You never know what you're going to get.
It is a lot like improv theater in the sense that you're looking, at least from what I understand, I haven't done a lot of it myself. You'd know more, Diana, I suppose. But looking at your target or your audience in case of being on stage, but like looking at your target and saying, what's gonna really get to this person? Well, she's a female. And it means she's a minority online. So I could really push a button by doing stuff that triggers certain reactions in females, including sexual death threats. I mean, it's not cool, but...
Right. This has been the big issue, and many women have complained that they feel that they're particularly picked on and subjected to harassment.
And that's exactly why they did it. That's what I'm saying. It's not because they want to kill her, they want her dead. It's because they knew that this was a sensitive thing to push a button for.
An individual named Susan Herring, she's a professor of information science and linguistics at Indiana University, and she goes on to say there's a minority of men, for the most part, who enjoy antagonizing women, particularly when they become more visible. And she says Kathy's become more visible on her blog, taking controversial positions, and it's triggered a lot of misogyny.
And among nerds, it's an even higher percentage.
So, these are the guys who want to grab the girl's ponytail and stick them in the inkwell in elementary school. And,
these are guys who
they're emotionally still in elementary
school.
These
are guys who never had a chance at wooing a girl or charming a girl or having sex with a girl, generally speaking. So They've got nothing to lose.
Actually, the person who's doing all this stuff is George Clooney.
When the beam of light is broken by a solid object, such as this head, the electric eye control opens the faucet, and there's your drink.
According to the sleeve of his great book, Beyond Fear, Thinking Sensibly About Security, in an uncertain world, Bruce Schneier is the go-to security expert for business leaders and policymakers. If only the policymakers would listen, we'd be safer, happier, and still free. Other books include Applied Cryptography, described by Wired as the book the NSA wanted never to be published. I think there's quite a few of those. And Secrets and Lies, which is not a romance novel. His current book, Beyond Fear, deals with security issues ranging from personal safety to national security and terrorism. He also writes frequently for Wired and the Minneapolis Star Tribune and many other fine publications. Last but not least, he just won a Pioneer Award from our friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Let's hear it for the AFF. And before we do talk to Bruce, I also want to let you know that we have a new video program segment, place10.zm.tv. So please go there to check for video clips of our various programs and other video clips. So welcome, Bruce.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great. So tell me, first of all, why did you become a security expert? Were you a secure child? Did anybody steal your lunchbox at school or...
I don't think I had any defining security episodes in my life. But you're right that security is something I think you're born with. I think it's a mentality. I mean, I remember as a kid walking into stores and figuring out how to shoplift, looking where the cameras were, or going with my mother to vote and looking at the security. I really think it's a mindset you're born with, to look at security in terms of a system and figure out how to get around it. It's a hacker mentality. It's a techie mentality. So, doing security just was natural. It's what I did normally.
That's interesting. I'm sure. I mean, you can go all the way back to hunter-gatherer. And you would find people probably who will work on security. I want to get right into the political area of security against terrorism. And you wrote that security works better if it's centrally coordinated but implemented in a distributed manner. So tell us a little bit about that and maybe say a bit about how that might work.
Well, let's sort of take each one in turn. It's important for security, especially something as broad as national security, for there to be a lot of central coordination, that you can't have one area doing one thing, another area doing another thing, and then them not talking to each other. It's important to share information. It's important for people to know what's going on, for information to move up and down chains of command and across jurisdictions quickly, because when things happen You need a lot of coordination. I mean, you can see coordination failures again and again in the aftermath of 9/11, Hurricane Katrina. When you look at what went wrong, a lot of it was the lack of coordination, that people didn't know what other people were doing. So there's a lot of replication of effort, a lot of things that were obvious that everyone thought someone else was doing. So coordination is real important. The other half of that is distributed implementation, that you can't be so rigid that your people in the field can't make decisions. A lot of times in security today, we see smart people being replaced by rules. And the great example is the TSA, which will blindly follow the stupidest rule rather than using common sense. Security works much better when the individuals at the sort of the point of security, the guards, the policemen, the customs agents, are well trained and have the ability to follow their instincts. When you think about how September 11th could have been prevented, it was a field agent in Minnesota who really first put her finger on the plot, but couldn't get her voice heard, and she didn't have the power to do anything herself. When you look at the real successes against terrorism at the borders, it's custom agents who are not following rules but are sort of noticing something suspicious and following their instincts. So security works best when it's centrally coordinated but distributedly implemented. A great example is the Marine Corps. That's very much their model for everybody. That there's a lot of coordination, but individual Marines in the field have a lot of autonomy. They're trained well and they're trusted. And it's a good fighting force because of that.
So you're talking about decentralization, basically, the organizations making decisions on the local level.
Right. And another analogy is the human body. Right. There's a lot of coordination, but it's a very distributed organism. You know, the pieces of our body do things autonomously without waiting for approval. So a lot of communication back and forth, a lot of coordination, but different pieces have their job and they're empowered to do it. And you get a lot more robustness, reliability because of it.
What about radically democratized security, like open source kinds of efforts involving citizens, that kind of thing?
You know, it's good and bad. Depends how it works. I like open source intelligence. I like open source information gathering, information dissemination. There's a lot of value in that. There's a lot of value in open source, you know, looking at data. There's a lot to be learned there. You know, the downside of that is something like TIA, which is Total Information Awareness, where you have citizens basically reporting on each other. You know, people spying on each other. And there you get pretty much nothing but false alarms, people turning each other in because their food smells funny or they don't pray at the right time. So, you know, done right, a radically democratized distributed security model works. Done wrong, you get East Germany where everyone spies on their friends.
Now, they were trying to get the postmen to spy on us for a while.
Right. They're working on the postmen and the meter readers.
Please,
you know, people
Mr.
Who
postman.
Yeah, I mean that will work well if the postmen are properly trained, right? Where that'll fail, if you tell a bunch of postmen, report anything suspicious. Because honestly, they don't know what suspicious looks like in this context. So the question is, given all the police resources we have, what should they be doing? I don't want them chasing all the false alarms from the postmen and meter readers when they could be doing something more useful. So that's a bad use. But if you train them properly, you'll have something better. But then you don't have a postman anymore, right? You have a security officer. So you think of a customs agent who will do the same thing, right? They're going to watch people and they're going to look for something suspicious. But they're trained in how to do it, right? So they're less likely to be overtly racist or just to fall for dumb profiles. Right, they're more likely to look for actually suspicious things. So whether that works is the training. You know, and it's true for pretty much all open source security models. You think of open source software. You know, having a bunch of random people look at the code, tell you if it's secure, won't work. If you have well-trained people who look at the code, that will work. Right? Open source just means you can see it. It doesn't guarantee that the right people will see it.
Right. It seems like, I mean, even with trained security people, it seems like they make an awful lot of errors from what I can tell. I tend to think over the last couple of years that America has been taken over by that can't-do spirit. Is there anything you can tell us about trained security people and how they could improve their efforts?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do, but they're still going to always make errors. I mean, fundamentally, the problem is in the mathematics. It's called the base rate fallacy. There are simply so few terrorists out there that even a highly accurate test, whether it's automatic or human-based, will almost always be a false alarm. That's just the way the math works. You can't help that. And, you know, the trick is going to be to minimize the false alarms. They'll always overwhelm the true attacks. Right, and that's not going to change. So you almost can't look at it as a raw number. You've got to look at the false alarms versus the real alarms versus the real attacks missed, and look at all the numbers together. But yeah, terrorist attacks are rare. They almost never happen. If you stop someone in airport security, no matter how good you are, it's going to be a false alarm, overwhelmingly. You know, once every few years, it'll be a real attack somewhere in the U.S., or maybe not even that much. You know, that's just the way the math is going to run. What training does, right? You know, I mean, training does two things. You're more likely to not to stop someone based on a dumb reason, right? You know, when airport security stops a grandma with a pocket knife, that's a false alarm. I mean, that's not a success. That's a failure. You know, we're stopping people based on the notion that carrying a small knife means you're dangerous, which is, of course, ridiculous. So the trick is going to be to alarm on things that are actually suspicious. So you spend your time wisely. The fact that almost everybody will end up being a false alarm is just, I mean, that's just the nature of the problem.
So most of us, I mean, experience the so-called war on terror in one place, and that's at the airport. What are they doing right, and what are they doing wrong at the airport? Are they doing anything right?
You know, since September 11th, exactly two things have made us safer. The first one is reinforcing the cockpit door, which should have been done decades ago. The second one is convincing passengers to have to fight back, which happened automatically. I mean, everything else is security theater, is window dressing. You can argue that sky marshals are also effective. I'm not convinced. And actually, if you pretend you have sky marshals, you don't even actually have to have them, right? The benefit of sky marshals is in the idea of them, not in the execution. But those two things have been done right. After that, I think everything's been a waste of money, a waste of time. I think heightened airport security at the passenger point of screening has been a waste of time. Right? It's caught exactly nobody, and it's just inconvenienced lots of people. Fly list has been a complete waste of time. It's caught exactly nobody. The color-coded threat alerts, nothing I see is valuable.
A Boing Boing headline from just a few days ago was TSA missed 90% of bombs at Denver Airport. They weren't talking about real bombs, but a test that was now was done. So it does seem that this is very difficult to do.
And the real news there is it wasn't even surprising. I mean, this is consistent in TSA tests, both before 9/11 and after 9/11. We haven't gotten any better. We're spending a lot more money. We're pissing off a lot more flyers, and we're not doing any better. And, you know, I mean, there's a game we're playing, right? You know, you think about airport security. We take away guns and bombs, so the terrorists use box cutters. So we take away box cutters and small knives, and they put explosives in their shoes. We screen shoes, so they use liquids. Now we take away liquids. They're going to do something else, right? This is a game we can't win. I'm sick of playing it. I'd rather play a game we can win.
The reactive thing is terribly absurd. I mean, the whole shoe bomber thing, my ongoing joke is that if he was an ass bomber, you know, taxpayers would be buying a lot of Vaseline by this point.
And what I say is that we should be glad he wasn't the underwear bomber.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think about John Gilmore's court fight that he shouldn't have to present an ID to fly inside the country? Do you think that's a legitimate goal on his part?
Well, I mean, the legal and constitutional issues, I don't know. And I know they're very complex, and unfortunately lost on those grounds. For security purposes, there's absolutely no point to the photo ID. I mean, if you think about it, everybody has a photo ID. All the 9/11 terrorists had a photo ID. The Unabomber had one. Timothy McVeigh had one. The DC snipers have one. You have one. I have one. There is no value to check photo ID. For security. We pretend there is, right? We think there's this big master list of bad guys, and if we look you up against the list, we'll know if you're a bad guy and he won't let you on the plane. Right? You know, it's completely absurd. We have no such list. The no-fly list we have is full of innocent people. It catches nobody who's guilty and everybody who's innocent. We've proven again and again that even if your name is Osama bin Laden, you can easily fly under someone else's name. This isn't even hard. So there is absolutely no value to the photo ID check. So, you know, I applaud Gilmore's efforts, not based on the constitutional issues, but the fact that it's a complete waste of security money. That we're wasting our time with pretending that it's making us safer when it's actually not. Right? That's my main complaint.
So if you were in charge of airport security, are there any things that you would implement?
I think we should ratchet passenger screening down to pre-9/11 levels. I think that was good enough. I like seeing positive bag matching. It was something that was been done in Europe for decades, and the U.S. airlines screamed and screamed and refused to do it, and now they are. So I think that's a good idea for checked baggage. Reinforcing the cockpit door. Again, the airlines opposed it for 20 or so years and just now did it after September 11th. That's a good thing. Passengers know they have to fight back. That's good. I would take all the extra money for airport security and have well-trained guards, both uniform and plainclothes, walking through the airports looking for suspicious people. That's what I would do. And the rest of the money I would give back. Because honestly, if we secure our airports and the terrorists go bomb shopping malls, we've wasted our money. Right? I tend to dislike security measures that require us to guess the plot correctly. Because if you guess wrong, it's a wasted money. And it's not even a fair game. It's not like we pick our security, they pick their plot, we see who wins. The game is we pick our security, they look at our security, and then they pick our plot. Right? The way to spend money on security, airport security and security in general, is intelligence, investigation, and emergency response. Right? Things that will be effective regardless of what the terrorists are planning. Not things that are only effective if you happen to guess what the terrorists are planning correctly. That's real important. So I want airport security to a level, but I don't want it so high that I'm wasting money that you better spend elsewhere.
Now, when you emphasize intelligence, is there any truth to the claims that were made by various intelligence agencies that as a result of the Church Committee in the mid-1970s that intelligence people couldn't do things that they should have been able to do to protect us?
You know, I think that's overstated. When you look at the controls that were put in by the Church Committee, they were put in to stop very serious abuses by law enforcement, by the police, by the intelligence, by NSA, by the CIA, and they make a lot of sense. If you look at the failures of 9/11, they weren't failures based on the Church Commission restrictions. They were failures based on the own internal politics inside the FBI. So I think that's largely overstated. And I think we're making a mistake by dismantling those protections. I mean, those affect are also security measures. They protect us from abuses by government, which unfortunately are far more common than terrorist attacks. So, you know, you look at really what went wrong in 9/11. I mean, in a lot of ways, we got unlucky. You know, a lot of things could have just gone right and they happened not to. And where they did actually go wrong, they were failures inside the bureaucracy. They were not failures of sharing between intelligence and law enforcement, as some people say. I mean, that stuff was able to be shared and was within the controls of the Church Commission. The problem was people didn't understand it and couldn't act on it. Now, a lot of this is hard to analyze. It's really easy after the fact to connect the dots. It's really easy to say, here's all the evidence and you missed it. Right? Before the fact, you've got millions of potential plots. Right? Lots and lots of things turn out to be nothing. So you're chasing so many leads, so many different events, so many different possibilities. And this is just one of them. You know, it's not the important one until after it happens. So I'm very suspicious of after the fact, here's what you should have done type arguments. Because after the fact, it's really easy to see what you should have done. Before the fact, it's much harder.
We are talking to Bruce Schneier, and we're going to listen to some music that's going to make you feel very insecure, and we'll be back in a few minutes. I'm Welcome back, Bruce.
And thank you.
Do you ever watch the TV show Numbers?
You know, I don't. I people tell me I should, and I do see plot summaries occasionally. It looks kind of neat, but no, I'm not a big TV person, unfortunately.
It's pretty amusing, but it makes it look like if you combine data mining with some complexity theory, you can predict everything anybody will do and exactly when and where they'll show up. And
you know, if that was true, there'd be a lot more people making money on Wall Street, wouldn't there?
Right. What are the limitations of data mining? You find data mining pretty much useless in the case of terrorism, but you find it useful in other areas.
So data mining is a really interesting area of mathematics and science, and it has phenomenal value. The success story of data mining is credit cards. The credit card companies use data mining to constantly look at the stream of credit card transactions and find credit cards that have been stolen. And I'll give you an example. I mean, I use my credit card all over the world. One day I use it in four different countries, two of them in Eastern Europe. And my credit card doesn't get stopped. Occasionally I get a call saying, hey, you know, something suspicious, can you verify it? But my credit card has never been stopped on the fly. I was in Canada last summer. I was in Winnipeg. And my credit card number was skimmed at a restaurant. And two transactions later, the card was canceled. That is data mining, right? And the reason that works is there's a bunch of reasons it works. It works because credit card thieves are relatively numerous, right? There's some percentage of credit cards that are stolen every year, and it's in the single digits. Credit card thieves tend to follow standard profiles. The profile they caught for my thief was that the fraudster bought gas first, and you do that to test if the card is valid. And then you go to some large department store, they went to Canadian Tire, and buy a bunch of things that are easily fencible. And that's what the fraudster did. And he was caught immediately because of that. So there's a lot of thieves out there with respect to the general population of card users. There is a well-defined profile that is relatively easy to find. And three, the cost for false alarms isn't that great, right? Most of the time, it's just a phone call we get, and we're actually happy to receive them. We think it helps us. Or, you know, in extreme cases, they cut the card, and you have to call and get it reinstated. I do have a friend who the same year did the same thing. He, with his own card, bought gas and then went to a jewelry store and bought an engagement ring. And his credit card was canceled after that. He called and had it reinstated. It took a couple of minutes. You know, it was kind of funny. So that's where data mining works great. It works great looking for toll fraud. The same types of systems go through the telephone calling records looking for stolen SIM cards or stolen cell phones, you know, things like that. Where it doesn't work well is in looking for terrorists, because it doesn't have any of those good characteristics, right? The number of terrorists with respect to the general population is infinitesimally smaller than the number of credit card fraudsters, the number of credit cards. So that's one. Two, there is no well-defined profile. There isn't this profile of a terrorist that you can easily pick out. You know, and you hear all sorts of things when a lot of people talk about them, right? People who move suddenly. You know, one-fifth of the population does that. Depends on who you talk to and you communicate with. You know, lots of people have weird friends. You know, in a lot of ways, a surprise birthday party looks like a terrorist attack, right? The only difference is how it's executed. So you don't have that profile. You don't have this large database of existing events that you can data mine for a profile, right? In the credit card case, you could look at the millions of credit card frauds and look for the common denominators. Hey, they buy gas, then they buy something fencible. We can search for that. There isn't that database for terrorists. The third problem is false alarms are expensive. Right? For a credit card, they're cheap. A phone call, or you turn off the card and they have to reinstate it. For looking for a terrorist plot, a false alarm is what? 1, 2, 3 weeks of, you know, a handful of FBI agents? It's an enormous amount of money, an enormous amount of effort. So when you apply the math to looking for terrorist attacks, you have no good profile. right? There are so many false alarms, you'll never find a real attack. And the false alarms are so expensive, they divert resources from what could be actually useful anti-terrorist activities. So I don't think it's ever going to work. I mean, the numbers are just not on your side. The science doesn't go in that direction. It is far more valuable to do, you know, traditional police and investigative work. If you think of what caught the London liquid bombers, right? It wasn't data mining. It wasn't profiling at the airports. It wasn't any of these newfangled ideas. It was old-fashioned detective work. It was following the chain. It was following the lead. It was smart investigators investigating. And it's not sexy. I mean, it's the same thing you'll see in 1960s police dramas, but it's what's effective. And diverting resources from that, you better have something really good before you're going to be more effective. And data mining just isn't.
Yeah, I guess the idea of total information awareness would seem sexy to some portion of the geek population, actually.
Yeah, but it sounds
that's
good.
That's where it came from.
But it's a way to harness technology to solve the problem, and we're so desperate to do that. And we're so used to it working in other areas of society. You know, you just apply more computing power and you get better results. Right. This is fundamentally a human problem. It's not a data problem. Right? It's not a problem if we don't have enough data, we don't have enough data analysis. It's a problem of human intelligence connecting the dots. You know, I mean, if I'm looking for a needle in a haystack, throwing more hay on the pile isn't going to solve my problem. I need a better way to methodically follow the lead into the haystack to the needle. Right. And it's not going to be through data mining. It's not going to be through broad surveillance. It's not going to be through lists and through you know, these all these new surveillance methods. It's going to be through the old-fashioned detective work. And that's going to keep us safe. It's going to keep us safe, again, regardless of the plot. I mean, if you think about another lesson of the liquid plot is that if they got to the airport, it would have gotten through. It would have gotten through all the enhanced screening. It would have gotten through all the enhanced profiling. You know, well, there's a lot of discussion about whether the plot was feasible. But if you assume it was feasible, it would have worked and it would have gotten through. Right. The reason it failed had nothing to do with airport security.
Well, moving on from terrorism, but still thinking about haystacks, you have a bit in Beyond Fear about learning about security from insects, which I found really fascinating. What can we learn from insects?
You know, there's a lot to be learned from security from the natural world in general. I mean, you know, all species have evolved as security beings, right? We need to survive enough to reproduce. We need to be able to protect our offspring so they can survive. We need to protect our food supply. We attack other creatures and attempt to kill them and eat them. There's so much security interplay in the natural world, and it's a great source of strategies, of anecdotes. I find insects particularly valuable because they evolve so quickly. Because you see so many interesting strategies in the insect world just because of the wacky evolutionary turns they take. And evolution is interesting. Right? Evolution doesn't give you the optimal security measure. Right? Evolution tries security measures at random and stops at the first one that just barely works. So you tend to get really weird security in the insect world.
So you get novel ideas, potentially novel ideas, by observing insects.
Well, it's less novel ideas because the basic security mechanisms are pretty much the same. I mean, what's different is the details, which depends a lot on technology and scenario and implementation. But you do get some real neat examples of, you know, distributed security measures. If you think of the way ants protect their colony, there are ant species that just wander around randomly, and if they hit a predator or a threat, they run right back to their colony to alert everybody. You know, so there's sort of an interesting security strategy. You just sort of do random things if you have enough cheap resources, right? Because individual ants are very cheap and very expendable. If you have enough resources, that's a perfectly reasonable strategy. I've seen different actually, this is a plant. There's a lima bean plant I wrote about that effectively calls an airstrike, that when it's attacked by a certain mite, it releases a chemical that attracts a predator mite that will eat the mite that's attacking it. You know, very clever. Reproduction. I mean, you look at the two models of protecting offspring. There is the lobster model, which is have millions of offspring and hope for the best, right? A few will reach maturity. Or the human model of have very few offspring and guard them for 18 years. Right? Two very different security strategies for fundamentally the same outcome.
Moving on to another topic. Why does the increasing complexity of systems make us more insecure?
So I've been saying for years that complexity is the worst enemy of security. That as systems get more complex, they get less secure. Yeah, and it's a bunch of reasons, right? Complexity means exceptions. Complexity means, many more different things to secure, right? Compare securing a very simple home with one door and one window with, a large office building or an airport, with many more entrances and exits and people moving in and out and goods and materials. Compare a very simple computer system with a complex one on the internet. Right now, my operating system is far more complex than it used to be. So there's many more lines of code, each of which could have a vulnerability or a mistake. There are dozens more protocols on the internet now than there used to be. Right, each one could have a vulnerability. As you pile on complexity, you just pile a number of things you have to worry about. Very simple is easy. I can stand at my door, and secure it. But if I've got seven doors and 18 windows and a chimney and access through my garage, it's a lot harder.
Does the person trying to break security into a complex system have to be smarter than, your average climbing the window and grab something person?
Well, it depends, because security is as strong as the weakest link. So the climb in the window person might have to do the same attack. But if there's one window versus 100 windows, he'll have an easier job because the likelihood that one of those windows happens to be open is relatively high. So very often the attacker gets to pick, the scenario, the strategy, the time, the place of his attack where the defender has to be on guard all the time. So that's where complexity really hurts the defender because there's just so many more possibilities. I mean, think of, terrorism is, again, a good example. If you look at the number of potential terrorist targets in the U.S., it's so enormous that defending them is a waste of time. Right? If you are a single family concerned about yourself, then it's a little easier to defend yourself because it's just one thing. So complexity tends to favor the attacker. It puts the defender at a disadvantage. Now, of course, we like complexity. I mean, I like the fact that my computer today runs Skype and so many other protocols. It makes it much more rich environment, right. But it does make it less secure. And to me, this answers, I think, a very puzzling question of why security isn't getting any better. Right? Computers make things better, whether it's word processing or image quality, whatever it is, you wait a couple generations and it'll get better naturally because processors get better and software gets better and hardware gets better. But security has been getting worse. And I think what's going on is security is getting better. It is improving. But complexity is getting worse faster. So we're losing ground even though we're improving.
I hate to think of what happens as technology gets even more complex and we start getting into nanotechnology and so forth. And, advocates of nanotech try to reassure us that there are ways of securing these types of systems.
And I'm sure there are ways, right? I'm not sure they're perfect enough or good enough.
Right.
One of the problems we have with very technological systems is that failures are much more serious. And if you think about the whole weapons of mass destruction debate, there's a lot of rhetoric and there's a lot of hysteria. But the core interesting problem there is that you have weapons which are far more dangerous than they used to be 10, 20 years ago,
right.
And will be far more dangerous in 10, 20 years. That technology gives the attacker so much more leverage that a small failure becomes a huge failure. I mean, in nanotechnology, I think is similar, right? A small failure can cascade into a large failure. You need to build security to compartmentalize failures. Very hard to do when you don't understand the technology.
Now, if we enter a society very much like the ones that have been written about in various cyberpunk novels in the early 90s and so forth, and people can run around with suitcase nukes or bioterror weapons that are extraordinary, you know, this power goes from the government to the small group to the individual. Does that imply a need for a total surveillance society? Or basically we can watch everything everybody is doing all the time?
You know, I don't think it implies that. It does imply we do need some kind of different security. Right? The problem we have, I mean, society is inherently good. Most people are inherently honest. Society would fall apart if that weren't true. And I 100% believe that. What crime is, terrorism crime, the bad guys are in a sense attacks on the honest. I mean, all of security is a tax. It taxes us honest people to protect us against the dishonest people. So you think of the dishonest people as noise in the smooth running of society. They create noise. The problem with some of these scenarios where the attacker has enormous amounts of leverage is that the noise becomes greater, right? That a single person can do a lot more disrupting. And whether he's politically motivated or maybe, you know, psychologically unbalanced or, you know, whatever the reason is, he can do more damage. I don't believe that surveilling everybody will solve the problem, which is why I don't think that's going to be the solution. But there will be some sort of things that are required, whether they are tight controls on the technology or different ways to deal with some of these problems. We have to start thinking about them. But, you know, universal surveillance, I don't think is going to get us where we need to go. So I sort of discount it as ineffective, not even as I don't want to live in a society that has that.
I mean, do you think on the whole that we are just in for at least a somewhat more authoritarian scenario than the sort of things that, say, libertarians and anarchists would hope for?
I think politically we are. I think politics moves in, you know, 20-year cycles or so, and we are in a cycle of a greater police state, of more controls, of more surveillance, of more people watching other people and people not being free to do what they want. I think that'll change. I think, you know, another 10, 13, 15 years, the pendulum will swing back. But I think it'll take that long.
So speaking of changes in the political system, I have one last question. Let's say President Obama asks you to be the Homeland Security Director. Do you accept the job, and what do you do with it?
You know, it's a funny question, and in my fantasies I think about it. God, taking a high-profile political job in today's sort of media climate seems like a really dumb thing to do. So yeah. I don't know if I would want to do it. I'd rather be the guy behind the scenes, does the actual work, rather than the guy who stands up and sort of takes the media hits. But, you know, if I was in charge, I mean, if I was in charge of Homeland Security, I would spend money on intelligence, investigation, and emergency response. I mean, that's where I'll get the best value. I think there is security inherent in civil liberties, in privacy and freedom. So I wouldn't be doing any messing with that.
Is one of the good responses to this to simply build up our medical system and our hospital system and have it functioning really well?
You know, that's part of it. It's certainly the hospital system. A lot of it is being able to deal with whatever happens. You know, I mean, if you think about the aftermath of a terrorist attack or of a natural disaster are the same. You need first responders. You need the ability to get people on the ground and do what needs to be done quickly to reassure people, to stop panic, to help people. And I think that's real important. It's real important in our society that we do that. And I think that's as fundamental as, you know, police and fire, that emergency response in all its forms is something we need to do.
Okay,
maybe that's Homeland Security, maybe it's just common sense, but I think it's something very important to spend money on.
Before I let you go, what is up for you? Do you have any new books that you're working on? And I understand you do have a newsletter that people can subscribe to.
So I have my newsletter Cryptogram. It comes out monthly. Just go to schneier.com and look for Cryptogram. It's easy to find. It's free. It's basically me explaining the news. I enjoy writing it. People enjoy reading it. About 125,000 readers right now. That's also available daily in blog form if people want. My research right now is a lot on the human side of security. I've done a lot of work in the economics of security. And now I'm doing a lot of work in the psychology of security. You know, how people make security decisions, how they react to security. You know, why is it that we're getting security wrong? Why is it that people are falling for security theater and not doing what makes sense? And it turns out there's a lot of very interesting things about how the brain works, how we process security trade-offs. And I'm researching that. There's an enormous body of research which hasn't really been applied to the technological community. So, you know, I'm still very, very new in looking at this, but I think there's a lot there.
All right. Well, I want to thank you on coming on the show. I do want to tell the listeners to look for a link to Bruce Schneier's site on areyouseriousradio.com. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Love is the only weapon. Shit! Are you serious?